Star Walker Studios presents Game Master's Journey, your multidimensional RPG podcast. Hello, fellow gamer. Welcome to episode 157 of Game Master's Journey. I'm your host, Lex Starwalker. On this show, we discuss the craft and art of game mastering. I've been running RPGs for over 25 years now, and I produce this show in the hope that you can benefit from my experience, my triumphs, and my mistakes. I've got a great show for you today. I'm going to discuss designing the Trickster's Labyrinth, my first published D&D adventure. I've gotten some questions from listener GMs about designing this adventure and designing adventures to publish and just coming up with adventures to run for your players. So I'm going to field those questions and talk a bit about my experience publishing my first adventure. And hopefully it will not only be enlightening to any of you who are thinking about publishing an adventure of your own, but also just for GMs in general, because we're all making our own adventures to run for our players. Also, be sure to stick around all the way till the end of the show today. Towards the end of the show, in the wrap up, I'm going to talk a little bit about some of my experiences so far running the Hidden Shrine of Tomawakan, based on some listener feedback. I talk a little bit about some of the issues I found with the adventure and some of the changes I've been making to it and why. So I am streaming that campaign. We're going through a few of the adventures from Tales from the Yawning Portal, starting with the Hidden Shrine of Tomawakan. And I live stream that on my YouTube channel every Monday at 6 p.m. Pacific time. And you can find my YouTube channel, the link at starwalkerstudios.com at the website. And also, you can watch those videos anytime. So we're streaming live on Mondays at 6 p.m. Pacific. But if you can't make it then, the videos are up, you know, probably forever on my YouTube channel. So you can watch them anytime. But if you come during the live stream, you can get in a chat room with us and hang out. So I'll be talking about my adventure, the Trickster's Labyrinth, today, and that is up for sale right now at starwalkerstudios.com. So you can go check that out. It's a D&D adventure, and worked hard on it, had a lot of fun doing it, and I'm really hoping that you'll check it out and hopefully run it for your players, and let me know what you think of it and how it went for you. Today, I'm going to be discussing a subject near and dear to my heart, which is the creation of my first self-published RPG adventure that is out there in the wild, available to everyone who wants to pony up the dough to get a copy. So this was pretty cool and kind of a check mark on a bucket list of mine that I've had for a long time, which is to publish something. I've had articles published on websites and magazines and things like that. But as far as a book, something completely my own, just done all by myself, this was the first thing. And I'm really proud of it, and I enjoyed doing it, and I'm really glad I did it. And I've gotten some questions from listeners about the adventure and about the process of creating it and publishing it and all that good stuff. So I thought it would be fun on the show to talk about it a little bit. Some of you out there may want to publish your own adventure someday or might be thinking of it. And even for everyone who isn't considering that, as game masters, we often create our own adventures. So I think some of this discussion will be useful just from the perspective of creating an original adventure to run for your group. So this is going to be a spoiler-free discussion of this adventure, because I hope that you will want to purchase it and run it for your group. And if any of your players are listening, I obviously wouldn't want to spoil my own adventure on the podcast and then it's useless to you. So I'm going to discuss it in a more general sense and talk about it as much as I can without spoiling any of the specifics that any of you who decide to run it might not want shared with your players. So I think and hope that this is going to be a pretty good adventure for less experienced GMs, for newer GMs, and that was one of the goals that I had as I was developing it, that I wanted to have it be something that is new GM friendly. You know, on this show, we talk a lot about how to be a better GM, and I have a lot of listeners who find the show because they're new GMs and they want to learn more about GMing or decide to become GMs while they're listening to the show. And so for all of you, I thought it would be nice if I'm going to publish an adventure to at least think about the new GMs out there and try to give some guidance to less experienced GMs. So this adventure is for third level characters and is designed to take characters from third level to fifth level. It's a D&D adventure. It is designed in such a way that you can do a lot of different things with it. You could just do it as a one-off adventure. You're just going to play this adventure and that's it. And if that's you, then I give my thoughts on how I would approach it as far as character creation, because like I said, it's an adventure for third level characters. So if you're going to run it for brand new characters and you want to create, you know, new third level characters, I mean, we have instructions on how to create a first level character in the player's handbook, but we don't so much have instructions on how to create a higher level character. So I give advice on how I would do that. Now, that might seem to the more experienced GMs like super obvious and why are you wasting time explaining this? But again, I wanted to make this friendly to newer GMs. And, you know, if you're a new GM and you've maybe never run a game before, or the sessions that you have run, you started at first level and worked your way forward, you know, you might wonder, well, how should I do this? How do I make a third level character from scratch? You know, what are some things I want to think about? And so I talk about that. Another way you could use this adventure is as part of a campaign you're already running. Now, obviously, you can't have been running the campaign for too long because it's only a third level adventure, but maybe you started out, you know, everybody made first level characters, you guys had a few adventures or whatever, they've gotten third level and you want to try to run this adventure. And if that's you, it works really well for that. And above and beyond being an adventure that you can just do it easily. Like you don't have to worry about, this adventure takes place in a desert and my player characters are in a rainforest right now. How do I get them from the rainforest to the desert so that they can run this adventure? And also, how do I do that without them gaining any more levels and then being too high of level for the adventure? That's something I've encountered a lot of times running modules, published modules myself is, well, the module is in this very specific location. My PCs aren't there. And how do I get them there? So this adventure is very easy to approach in that way. It doesn't matter what setting you're running in. It doesn't matter where in the setting you are. It doesn't matter what the last adventure the player characters did. It's very easy to get them into this adventure from anywhere they are and from anything they were doing before. Once the adventure's over, it's also very easy to get the player characters from where they are in the adventure to wherever you want them to go next, which could be where they started before they did this adventure, but it doesn't have to be. And in fact, due to the nature of the adventure, they could end up easily in a very different part of the world than they were in before they did this adventure. They could end up in a different world or on a different plane. They can end up really anywhere you want them to be. So it also works well as what I call a segue adventure, which is where, you know, let's say you have an adventure that you ran in a rainforest and now you want to run an adventure in a desert and they're a long ways apart, and you're wondering, gosh, how do I get the PCs from the rainforest to the desert? I really don't want to do a month long or more of traveling, and I don't want to just hand wave it, because, you know, that's a long way to travel in the world, and surely something would have interesting would have happened on the way, right? So what do I do? And that's when you need what I call a Segway adventure, an adventure that will take the PCs from place A to place B and provide you with something interesting that they can experience in between. And this adventure does this. So if you need to move the PCs from one place to another, whether that's within the same world to a different world, different plane, whatever, you can do that with this adventure. And it's super easy. So if you are running this as part of a larger campaign, I also give some thoughts on, you know, what you can do after you finish this adventure, kind of where to go from here kind of thing. And I even give thoughts on if the player characters want to return to the adventure location later, because the way I wrote the adventure, it's very likely that once the PCs complete it and they go on their way and continue on with whatever they're going to do next, it's very likely that they'll feel like they maybe have some unfinished business with this adventure, or it's something that, hey, you know, maybe when we're higher level and we're more powerful, we might want to come back here and revisit this, you know, kind of tie up some loose ends. So I give some thoughts on, you know, if your group of players decide to do that at a higher level and come back to this, on how to approach that and what are some things that you can do with that, and how you can do that. And also this adventure, like I think really all adventures, I think, but this adventure is easy to expand. So if you're digging the location, if you're digging the theme of the adventure and you want to do more with it, it's very easy to expand this and do even more with it. And I give some thoughts on that too. All right. So I think I've given some of the kind of introductory overview, preliminary stuff. I don't want to talk too much about just the general stuff of the adventure, because I've talked about it on the show before, and I want to get into new information. So let's go to some of the questions that I've gotten from listener GMs. So Dietrich Pfister wrote in, I hope I'm at least getting close on your name, sir, and said, since I'm planning on trying my hand at writing up adventures for a venture I'm involved with, I would certainly like to hear about the creative and planning process you used. So his first question is it linear or open-ended? So the adventure, I would say, is fairly linear. It's a dungeon crawl. It's a site-based adventure. So, I mean, it's not totally linear. I mean, there's more than one way to get through the adventure. There's more than one way the PCs could go. Like any good, you know, decent dungeon, you know, when they go into a room, there's more than one direction they could go, right? And the map of the adventure is set up in such a way that they don't have to go everywhere on the map. They could skip whole sections of the adventure, which is why, you know, when people ask me, well, how long will this take? I have to give a range. And on the product page, I give a range. So let's see here what that is. I don't remember off the top of my head. There we go. So I suggest that it will take somewhere between 3 to 5 4-hour sessions to complete. But honestly, I don't know that someone could do it in less than 3 sessions, even if they somehow knew exactly the way to go to take the shortest path through the adventure. I think it would take at least three sessions. But I could easily see a group taking more than 5. I mean, especially if they're like, we're going to visit every room, we're going to figure out everything. It could easily take longer. And then, of course, if you add anything to it as the GM, if you add more encounters, or you add more to the map, or whatever you add, you know, that could increase the amount of time you spend with it as well. So I would say in general, it's linear, because it is a dungeon, and, you know, kind of the goal is to complete the dungeon. So, you know, by nature, that's linear, but it's not completely linear in that the players have decisions to make as far as you know, how they approach that, and they don't have to, you know, complete every room. I've definitely seen dungeons where they're built in such a way that even though there are multiple possible paths through the dungeon, you kind of have to do the whole thing because there are little MacGuffins in various places that you have to get. So you basically have to do the entire thing. This isn't so much like that. There's definitely entire sections of the dungeon players could skip if they wanted to, and if they were lucky enough to go the correct way. It's also somewhat open-ended as far as how the players can, quote, defeat the adventure or beat the adventure. You know, there's more than one possible solution to this adventure, and it's up to the players to decide how they're going to approach that. So, you know, it's not completely linear, but it's not completely open-ended either. It's not a sandbox. It's not just a list of locations with no story or plot or anything like that. There is a story that the player characters can interact with. There are things going on that they can get involved with more or less, depending on how much they want to get involved with it and how inquisitive they are and how much they investigate and explore things. Dietrich's next question is, what inspired the adventure? That's a good question. I am trying to think of what inspired the adventure. I don't know that I can think of a specific thing that, quote, inspired the adventure as far as like a movie that I saw or a book I read or anything like that. But I can tell you as far as where the basic idea of this adventure came from was way back over a year ago. When I was working on the Gods of Primordia, I came up with my god of the trickery domain, who is the god or goddess Emora. And the first idea I had that eventually grew into this adventure was I had this idea of a dungeon that was either created by Emora or created by a follower of Emora or created as a homage to Emora. And the first idea was that it would be like a proving ground. Like it would be this dungeon just filled with all kinds of traps and stuff and puzzles. And the original idea was that by making your way through this dungeon, you could actually gain Emora's favor and prove to Emora that you were worthwhile. And that aspect of it, that it was a kind of a trial overseen by Emora, actually persisted fairly late into the development of the adventure. And then there was, I guess, one sort of inspiration for the adventure was the show Westworld. And towards the latter half of the development of this adventure, I watched Westworld, and there was one or two elements from that show that kind of inspired me to add this new layer to the adventure. And not a layer as in a level of the dungeon, but a layer as in a layer to the story of what was going on with this dungeon. One of the first kind of working titles I had for the dungeon was actually Emora's Labyrinth, because again, in the early planning stages, the idea was that this was a dungeon either created by her or created by a follower, like maybe a cleric of Emora or something like that. And that later changed, and with that, the name changed. But yeah, that was one of the early titles of it. And Dietrich then asked, what were some of the creative hurdles that you encountered? Wow, there were a lot of creative hurdles. You know, part of it was the initial concept that I had that I just shared with you. Eventually, I grew to not like it a whole lot. It started to seem a little like, you know, something I've seen a lot of times before and seemed a little, I don't know, contrived maybe. And so, you know, I decided to change that, and I decided to add more layers to the history. For instance, without giving too much away, the character or the force or whatever that is in control of the dungeon now when the PCs visit it is not the force that created the dungeon. So I added this other layer to its history, you know, because I thought, well, you know, let's have it be a little more complex than just, you know, person X built a dungeon for purpose Y, and that's all it is. So it was, you know, constructed by one person for one purpose, and then later was taken over by someone else, and the purpose changed somewhat. So I just did that to add a little bit of complexity, because I think just having a dungeon crawl where all it is, you know, kicking in doors and fighting monsters, unless it's really short, like something you do in a session or two, I think it gets old pretty quick. So I wanted there to be more substance to this for player characters who want a story or who want a mystery to solve, for those types of players, so that if they started digging beneath the surface and started approaching this as more than just fighting monsters and looking for treasure, I wanted there to be something there that they could discover that would be satisfying. So I added actually a couple layers beneath the surface that players could dig into. But on the other hand, it could be totally possible for a group to go through this dungeon and never really interact with that stuff and not learn much or anything about it, just depending how the players approach it. And I'd say, you know, some of the other creative hurdles that I encountered had to do, I don't know if you'd call it creative, but it had to do with the mechanics when it came to designing actual encounters, because I found it challenging to design encounters that fit the theme that I was going for and were using the monsters that I wanted to use, but still wasn't an encounter that was way too easy or way too hard. And balancing all of that was very challenging, you know, because on the one hand, I could come up with an encounter that made total sense as far as the story and the adventure, but maybe it's way too easy or maybe it's way too hard. On the other hand, I could easily come up with an encounter that mechanically was an awesome encounter, was the right difficulty I was looking for, but didn't really make sense in the adventure. So finding a balance there was challenging, and actually part of the way that I ended up overcoming that challenge was by coming up with some of my own monsters. And then Dietrich says, what kinds of things spurred revisions, if any? Well, the one thing that spurred revisions that I'd already mentioned was the watching Westworld and having that inspire kind of another element to add in to the dungeon. And other than that, I mean, that was, I don't know whether to say it was a big revision or not. It was a big revision as far as the role-playing aspects of the dungeon and some of the story aspects of what was going on. It wasn't a huge revision as far as mechanical things. It did lead me to change some of the encounters and add some things and take some things away, but it didn't, at least mechanically, completely alter the dungeon. The biggest thing that caused revisions was actually my first play test of the adventure and running a group through it. Every session, every scene, every encounter, I was taking notes on things that worked really well, things that didn't work well, things that confused the players, or questions the players asked that I didn't have answers for in the written adventure. Because I actually, when I, you know, it was one of the early drafts of the adventure, but I had, I forget which draft it was, but I had written and printed out the entire adventure before I ran it for players. And so I was trying to run it as if, you know, I was running this as a published adventure and I just know what's in the pages of the adventure. So I tried to really be mindful of that. And anytime the players asked me a question that I had to answer and I couldn't answer it based on what was in the adventure, I had to come up with an answer, or I had to answer it based on what I knew about the adventure but wasn't in the actual pages, I would always take notes of those so I could add that later. And there were a few times that the players just came up with really interesting questions or really interesting ideas of ways to approach things that led to me later adding new things into the dungeon to fit that. So, you know, I don't want to give us any super specific examples. I don't want to spoil anything. But, you know, there was a certain room in the dungeon where there were certain symbols, and the players asked questions about how many symbols there were and how they were oriented that led to me providing the GM with a lot more detailed information about these symbols and thinking about, you know, why that was and if there was anything the players could do with that information. Because, you know, one thing I've found time and time again running adventures that I create myself is even if you create some kind of detail that you don't really have a reason for it, it's just to add some flavor, players will tend to assume there's a reason for it. And sometimes they'll go down rabbit holes trying to find a reason for something. And you end up thinking, you know, at this point, if there isn't a reason for it, it's going to seem really lame to the players, like you don't know what you're doing, just because they've become so invested in trying to figure out what that reason is. And, you know, so in those situations, usually, you know, a good GM will come up with something. So there was a couple instances of that in the adventure where on the fly running it, I did come up with something. But then later, as I revised the adventure, I was like, okay, I'm going to actually put something in here, because if my players really dug into this, someone else's players might too. Josh Davis also wrote in with some questions of the adventure, and he says, what part of the adventure did you design first? So that's a really good question. So to kind of cast back in my murky memory, kind of the process I went through, I started with a basic concept, which was, you know, this crazy dungeon where there's going to be a lot of traps and there were going to be things that aren't what they seem. And the idea is for the PCs to get through it, to find the way out of it. And by doing so, kind of proving themselves or as a way to gauge, you know, how smart are these characters? How much ingenuity do they have? How capable are they? And so I started from that concept, and then I thought about, you know, what level of an adventure do I want to run? At that time, I was thinking I wanted to start at first level. And then I started thinking about encounters. And I started going through the monster manual. There's a great table of, you know, monsters by CR. So I went through some of the CRs I thought would be appropriate for the adventure and kind of made a list of what some of the cooler monsters were or monsters that I thought would work especially well for the adventure. And then I started looking for interesting combinations of monsters to use in encounters and started thinking about encounter locations, like environmental things that might come into play and things like that. And then once I had kind of an idea of some encounters maybe I wanted to do and some types of monsters I wanted to use, then I started fiddling around with a map and actually coming up with the location itself and what was where and things like that. But it's kind of hard to say like what I did first, because it was a lot of back and forth. You know, I started with a concept, and then I started looking for monsters and designing encounters. And then I went back to the concept and I'm like, okay, I want to do more with the concept. I want to make sure there's some story here. So I developed that more. And then I went back to the encounters and the monsters and do these all fit the concept that I've further developed now? Do I want to add something? And then it was probably pretty late in the process before I started thinking about rewards as far as like treasure and stuff like that. But yeah, it was kind of a back and forth, going back and forth between working on kind of the story aspect of it and the more mechanic gameplay aspect and just going back and forth. Josh also asks, how did you settle on a character level range? So that's an interesting question, because that's something I actually struggled quite a bit with. Because when I originally started designing this adventure, I wanted it to be for first level characters. And I think, I don't know, I probably wasted at least a month or two trying to design this adventure and trying to make it work for first level characters. And I was just having so many problems with it. And what it really came down to was a lot of the monsters I wanted to use were too high a CR for first level characters. And I didn't want to make it super long. It actually, my original plan, I wanted it to be a one shot. I wanted it to be an adventure you could do in one or two sessions. And it ended up being, you know, quite a bit longer than that, probably twice that at least. And, you know, I was like, well, there's no way I can start at first level and I can get where I want to get as far as the some of the encounters I want to do, you know, without this having this be this long slog of an adventure that, you know, takes the characters from like level 1 to 5 or whatever. And I didn't want to do that, but I resisted starting at a level other than 1 because I thought, well, you know, most DMs out there probably want to start their campaigns at first level. And I don't want to have to worry about, you know, well, what were you doing before this? I want this to be able to kick off a campaign. But I just couldn't make the adventure I wanted to make at first level. So then I finally got to this point. I was so frustrated with it that I was like, you know what? Screw it. I'm like, you know, I'm just going to start designing the thing the way I want to run it. And I'm not even going to worry about what level the player characters are. And I'm just going to see what happens. So I went back to my list of monsters I'd made and I just started putting, you know, encounters together and doing the map. And I got about halfway through that. And then I went back and said, okay, what level of characters could handle this? And that's really where I came up. I was, you know, I came up with the, you know, level 3 to 5 thing. I'm like, you know, I think this would be okay for, you know, characters as low as 3rd level or as high as 5th level. And so that's kind of how I decided on that level range. And then I just kind of retooled it a bit so that, you know, the encounters near the beginning of the adventure were more doable for 3rd level characters and then had more of the harder encounters further away from where the characters start. But that said, well, first of all, the dungeon isn't linear. There's more than one way you can go through the dungeon. And I didn't want it to feel like an MMO where it's like, oh, now we're in the level 4 zone. Oh, now we're in the level 5 zone. So I did make sure that the first, I don't know, encounter or so that the player characters would come upon, whatever direction they went, I made sure that those were at least doable for 3rd level characters. But other than that, I kind of mixed it up. And I know that my first playtest group, when they ran it, they actually, I think the first or second room they went into after the first one ended up being something that was way too hard for them. It was like a 5th level encounter. And luckily the players were smart enough to just get out of there and get away from it. But, you know, they just happened to pick one of the routes that led to some tougher encounters much sooner than if they would have gone a different way. But I wanted that because I didn't want it to be grindy and I wanted it to matter which way the player characters go. And I wanted there to be moments where they might encounter something that they weren't ready for yet and they needed to be smart enough to run away. And then Josh says, how much homebrew versus out of the box did you use for monsters, traps, items, etc.? So, I can't say for sure as far as a percentage without going and looking through it and counting. I feel like as far as monsters, I feel like maybe about 25% was homebrew and the rest was quote out of the box from the monster manual. Traps were, I mean, I didn't use traps directly from the monster man or the Dungeon Master's Guide, but those are really just example traps anyway. I mean, I did use their system as far as deciding, you know, how much damage traps would do and what the save DCs would be and stuff like that. But pretty much all of the traps, I came up with my own, you know, what the trap was. I didn't just use one of the example traps from the monster manual. I mean, there might actually, I was going to say there might have been just your standard pit trap in there, but I don't think there actually was just a standard pit trap. So, you know, the traps were mainly homebrewed. Magic items, those were probably mostly out of the box. I'm trying to think. Well, I know there's at least one magic item that I added. I think there might have only been the one the one magic item that I created for it, and the rest were out of the box. But yeah, the monsters, I created a few new monsters. Some of the monsters I created were just tougher versions of monsters from the monster manual. So there were, I don't know, a few monsters where I basically made a legendary version of a non-legendary monster from the monster manual, because I wanted a good encounter with just a few monsters or just one monster, and the monster I wanted to use wouldn't have been very effective. So I was like, hey, I'll just make him legendary and that'll work a lot better. And for those of you that have listened to the show for a while, you might remember me discussing on a few episodes a while back about figuring out the CR of legendary monsters. And that's kind of where that conversation came from, as I was designing this adventure and making legendary versions of monsters and then figuring out, well, what does this do to their CR? Because we don't have, you know, a direct guideline for that. You know, you have to kind of figure it out, that there's nowhere in the DMG where they're like, if you take a monster and make it legendary, it adds this much to the CR. You know, you have to kind of go through that whole CR calculation again. And so, you know, that was very, very challenging, because as I talked about in those episodes, the CR system of fifth edition is at least as much art as it is science. So, you know, even if you understand the system as it's presented in the DMG perfectly, you're not always going to get the same CR that Wizards did if you try to reverse engineer their monsters. So, you know, it can be challenging to figure that out, because they're making judgment calls. It's not just, you know, plugging numbers into the quadratic formula. It's not that simple. There are judgment calls that are made. So you have to, or at least what I did was reverse engineer a lot of their monsters, and the ones where I'm getting a different answer than what they got, figuring out why I think they made it a higher or lesser CR than the method they gave us to determine CR is indicating. And then doing enough of that I felt I kind of grasped where they were coming from, so that when I turned to my new monsters I was designing, that I could give them an appropriate CR. So yeah, homebrewing the monsters was very challenging. I'm pretty happy with them, and I'm fairly confident in my CRs. But if there's one thing that I wonder about, or if there's one thing I'm kind of like, oh, I hope this is right, it's the CRs. I think the monsters are fine as far as what they do, but whether, you know, I gave them the same CR Wizards would have if they designed them, I think so, but you know, I don't know for sure. I unfortunately can't read their minds, and they haven't told us all the nuts and bolts of how all that works. But I'm happy with the way they turned out.
This is Matthew Colville, and you're listening to Game Master's Journey.
I want to give a quick shout out to the patrons of Starwalker Studios. The support of the patrons makes this show possible. If you enjoy Game Master's Journey and you'd like to give a little back, becoming a patron is a great way to do so. Patrons get some cool perks like game material I make for Primordia and access to a special monthly podcast I produce just for the patrons. I'd also like to give a huge shout out and thank you to my Tier 4 patron, Mr. Steve Strickland. Let's hear it for Steve.
Yeah.
Yes.
You the man. You the man.
Thank you so much, Steve, and thank you to all the patrons. You can find out more about becoming a patron by clicking on the Patreon button at the top of the show notes at starwalkerstudios.com. Boz Bunnick wrote in with some questions, and he says, did you rewrite parts of the adventure after revisiting or trying it out, and why? So yeah, I definitely did, and I talked about this a little bit already, but the playtesting I did was very enlightening. There were parts where I just added more information because the players were asking me questions that I didn't have answers written down for. So I tried to, as I was playtesting it, anytime I was coming up with stuff on the fly, I would either write down what I told the players, or I would just write down the answer or the question that the players asked me, so that I could later go back and add that information into the adventure. And there is a pretty big revision that I made to the adventure that came out of the playtest. And this one was interesting because, you know, most of the revisions, I playtested the adventure and then I went and made changes based on how the playtest went. But there was one revision I actually made during the actual playtest, and I didn't wait until the playtest was over. And I've actually kind of obliquely talked about this on the show too. And that was, I added an NPC to the adventure that wasn't in there before I did the first playtest. And the reason I did that is I like, as a GM, I like having a voice in any adventure, whether that's, you know, the innkeeper or one of the knight player character squire or someone they meet on the road or something like that. And I didn't really have that in this adventure. At least I didn't have an NPC that the players could speak with who was friendly and who could possibly be an ally of the player characters. And part of this was some of the new elements that I'd added later on in developing it. And I kind of had more history and more going on beneath the surface of the adventure. And as I was running the first playtest through it, I realized that unless the player characters asked the right questions or unless they investigated the right things, there wasn't really any way for them to discover a lot of that information. And of course, my first thought was, well, you know, I could have an NPC give them a hint. And then I realized I didn't have an NPC in the adventure that could do that. So in between two of the sessions of the playtest, I decided to add an NPC into the adventure and more than that, make it an NPC that could be an ally to the player characters. And so I added that NPC, and I'm sure anyone who reads the adventure, it'll be obvious who that NPC is. Her name is Alina, and she made a big difference in the adventure. And I think if I had to say what was one thing I added to the adventure that I think improved it the most, that would be one of the things, because she made it possible for the player characters to learn about a lot of the subtle things that were going on that I don't know they could have learned otherwise. And as a GM, you don't want to just hand out information for free. You know, you want there to be a way or a reason that the player characters could learn this information. So this NPC was a way that the GM could, if he or she wanted to, provide the players with information they were missing, and also gives the GM a chance to roleplay and interact with the players in a non-confrontational way if she wants to. So Boz also asks, did you start with the story, the main villain, an idea for the map setting? What inspired it? So I think I already basically talked about this, but I started with an idea for basically the location, which was this place created by Amora. And it grew out of that and changed. I mean, that was kind of the impetus that got the ball rolling. But then later, I decided not to have it have been created by Amora or even by a follower of Amora, but rather it fairly recently got taken over by someone who followed Amora. And that's kind of where those elements ended up coming in. And yeah, ironically, the main villain was one of the more later parts of the adventure that I came up with, because I didn't come up with the main villain until fairly late in the development. I think that might have been one of the last things I came up with before I did the first playtest, because the villain is a direct outgrowth of the history of the place and what's going on with it. So until then, I didn't really have a main villain, and I wasn't even sure that I was going to have a main villain. I thought it might just be a bunch of random stuff, or well, not random, but a bunch of weird stuff. But once I had like the history of it fleshed out, then it made sense to have this main villain. And Ryan Liljestrom asks, how much of the work put into the Trickster's Labyrinth ended up being specific to D&D, and 5th edition as opposed to being RPG agnostic? I'm not sure I completely understand that question. I mean, it's a D&D adventure. It's a 5th edition adventure. So as far as all the mechanics of the encounters and what monsters am I using and how much and what's the treasure and all that, I would say that was all pretty specific to D&D and 5th edition because it had to work in D&D 5th edition. However, you know, the basic concept and the map and what's going on and the history and all that, I mean, you could easily use a different system and, you know, you'd have to convert, you know, the monsters and stuff. But yeah, I guess I don't really understand the question. I mean, it's not a setting or it's not a game agnostic adventure, if there is such a thing. It's a D&D adventure. So it was very much designed specific for D&D. But I think that you could take, like, I don't know, if you played some other fantasy role-playing game, I think you could convert it. Just, you know, replace the D&D monsters with monsters from the game you're playing and replace the D&D magic items with magic items from the game you're playing. Or, for instance, let me talk about something I know something about. You could fairly easily make this a Numenera adventure. In fact, I think the actual kind of concept and story behind this adventure would work really well in Numenera, and it wouldn't be hard at all thematically at all to make it a Numenera adventure. You just change the magic items to ciphers and artifacts. The monsters, just change them to Numenera monsters. And some of the monsters, you could probably find Numenera monsters that were very similar, or you could make Numenera versions of the D&D monsters, however you wanted to approach it. But, you know, if you were a Numenera GM and you wanted to take this adventure and make it a Numenera adventure, I think it would be super easy to do. And I think it would work really well as a Numenera adventure. And it would be cool. And I don't know, it'd be fun to see that done or to do it myself, because in some ways it would be so similar. I think a lot of the aspects of the facility and what's going on there, and as far as what the player characters experience, could be very similar or even exactly the same, but just the flavor of it and the why things are happening and the explanation or lack of how things are happening would be very different as a Numenera adventure. It would be really interesting. That'd be kind of fun to do. So that's all the questions that I got. So let me see if there's anything else that I could talk about that hasn't come up that might be useful to you. So I guess the first thing I could talk about is kind of what I've learned from this, and maybe direct this at any of you who are maybe considering doing this yourself, considering creating an adventure to publish, or maybe taking an adventure that you ran for your group of players and publishing it. You know, as far as whether you should do that or not, I mean, I can't tell you that. I mean, only you can answer that question. But I can tell you kind of what my experience has been and what I've learned from the process. So first of all, I'd have to say that it was a lot more work than I thought it would. I've been running D&D and other RPGs, but D&D specifically, I've been running for over 25 years. And for all of that time, I've been running my own adventures. When I first started running D&D, when I first started running second edition D&D in, like, I don't know, 1992 or whatever it was, I don't even remember, it's a long time ago, I ran my own stuff. My very first adventure I ran as a DM, I ran my own stuff. In fact, I didn't run a published adventure until third edition. Third edition was the first, or 3.5 actually, was the first time I ran a published adventure. And even then, I ran like two or three sessions of Return to Elemental Evil, and like, I didn't like it, and I ended up running my own stuff. The only extensive experience I had running published adventures wasn't until Pathfinder. I ran a good amount of the Kingmaker adventure path, and then Numenera. I ran a lot of the published adventures for Numenera. So, you know, for the first at least decade and a half of running D&D and other RPGs, I did only my own adventures. So, I mean, you would think after 25 years of creating and running my own adventures that I would have known as well as anybody could how much work this would be. And I have to tell you, it was way, way more work than I thought it was going to be. There's so much more involved in publishing an adventure for everybody than there is in creating an adventure for your own player characters. Even if you were, let's say you've already created an adventure and you've already run it for your players and you're thinking, I'm just going to revise it and sell it. Even that is going to be way more work than you realize. Just the writing and editing and playtesting and then rewriting, re-editing, playtesting, just that was way, way more work and way, way more time than I realized it was going to be. And then on top of that, the layout and the art and the cover, which I didn't do, Nikki did all of that, but the amount of time she spent doing all of that blew my mind. And the thing's been out for, I don't know, a month or so now. And I have to say, if I travel back in time, and I don't know, you know, what it's going to do in the future, but if I travel back in time and told myself how many hours I would spend on this and how many of it I would sell, I would have never done it. So I guess the closest thing I'll come to giving you advice, if you're thinking about doing this yourself, is if you're doing this to make money, or if you're doing this even to be compensated for your time, don't do it. Now, if this is something where you're doing it just because you think it'll be fun and it's something you want to do, then maybe go for it. For me, I mean, it was kind of a perfect storm of when I started doing this, I was between jobs. I had a lot of time on my hands. I've always wanted to self-publish something. I've always wanted to write something. So for me, a lot of it was just, this was something I wanted to do. And it wasn't so much about trying to make money or even be compensated for my time. Because I'll tell you, unless the rate of sales picks up exponentially from what it's been so far, I'll never sell enough of this adventure to even make minimum wage for myself the time I put into it. Not to mention the time that Nikki put into it, doing the art and the layout and all of that. So, you know, as a way to make a living or as a means of supplemental income, I don't think it's a realistic thing to hope for. So I definitely wouldn't do it for those reasons. But, you know, if you just want to see your name in print or you want to share your adventures with a larger audience and things like that, then it can be a lot of fun, but it will take a lot more time than you think it will. A lot more time, like orders of magnitude more time. It's kind of interesting because it's a transition from just like a Word document, you know, of an adventure, which is, you know, when I do adventures for myself, I mean, they never go past the Word document phase. They never have, or OneNote, right? It's a transition from that to InDesign and having it be a PDF where things kind of go nuts. Because up until the point we started laying the thing out, you know, even a major revision wasn't that big of a deal. I would go into Word, I would make my changes, I would, you know, run a spell check or whatever, and then I would, you know, read through the entire thing and do, you know, one or two or three more editing passes just to make sure I caught any typos or errors that came about of the revisions I made. And I didn't just read the part that I changed. I read the whole thing. And you'd be surprised how every time I read through it, I'd find something that I missed before. So, you know, that wasn't such a big deal. But once we had the thing laid out and we've done three or four or five or six fairly minor revisions since we laid the thing out and put it up for sale, and those are just nuts to do and just take a ridiculous amount of time. because, you know, changing something in InDesign isn't nearly as easy as changing something in Word. And just adding a few words or taking a word out can change every page of the book from that point forward. And you have to go and change everything. So, that is a lot of the time that I wasn't expecting and was very surprised by. So I'm really interested to get feedback on this. I've heard from a couple people, some general feedback, but I'm really interested to hear from people who actually run it or play it, what they think of it and feedback. I definitely made some design decisions with it that are different than at least some of the adventures Wizards has done for fifth edition. I mean, Wizards doesn't do every adventure that they put out the same way. So one of those things that I did, one of those decisions I made was I don't have much read aloud text in the adventure. And I did that very intentionally, even though when I was working on a lot of the adventure was after Curse of Strahd came out, and Curse of Strahd is loaded with read aloud text. Now, Wizards has put out other adventures for fifth edition that don't have much read aloud text or don't have any read aloud text. But Curse of Strahd had read aloud text for, I think, everything that you encountered. And it was actually running Curse of Strahd where I really came to the decision that in my adventures, I don't want to use a lot of read aloud text because I found, at least for me as a GM running an adventure, if there's read aloud text, I tend to want to read it. And it's not so bad in an adventure where it's an occasional thing. And then you read this and that's fine. It's not a big deal. But if you're running an adventure and, like, say you're doing a dungeon and every single room of the dungeon has read aloud text, and especially if it's long, which it seems like anybody that does read aloud text, it doesn't matter if it's Wizards or someone else, they want to give you paragraphs of read aloud text. It's not good. The more time you spend as a GM with your face in a piece of paper reading to your players, the less good that is. And I've found running published adventures that it's much easier for me to take a good description of an area that's given to the GM that is not read aloud text and then paraphrase that and tell my players what they notice of that extemporaneously. It's much easier for me to do that with a description for the GM than it is to do the same thing with read aloud text and to take this read aloud text and instead of just reading it word for word, instead describe in my own words what the players are experiencing. And I'm not sure why that is, but that's the experience I've had. Also, you know, I found, especially in an adventure where there is a map, where it is a dungeon or some other location-based adventure where you have a map, that a lot of times the read aloud text is kind of redundant to what's on the map. For example, if you're using a map, why tell the players that the room is 10 feet by 10 feet when they can see that it's 10 feet by 10 feet on the map? So, you know, I don't think read aloud text should give you information that's on the map. And even if you're not showing the players the map, you, the GM, have the map. So you don't need read aloud text to tell you what's on the map. You can just look at the map and describe it to your players. So, you know, one of the decisions I made when I made this dungeon. I'm like, you know, there are some points where I have read aloud text, but that tends to be more when an NPC is speaking and more, you know, giving the GM kind of some help as far as this is what the NPC says and how they say it in case the GM's, you know, needing some help kind of getting the feel of that NPC. It's like, well, here you go. Here's some dialogue for this NPC. But, you know, even that, I'm not going to tell you everything that the NPC says because, you know, as a GM, you should be role-playing the NPC and coming up with their lines yourself, not reading a script that I give you. Another belief of mine is that running a published adventure does not eliminate the need for the GM to prepare for a session and should not be seen as a replacement for having to prepare for sessions. I don't know if there are adventures out there that you can just pick up the adventure and run it without studying it and preparing it ahead of time. I've never seen one. I think Monte Cook Games took a stab at something like that. They put out some, what they call it, like instant adventures or something for Numenera. And even those, I mean, you couldn't really just sit there and run that without reading it and studying it and preparing it ahead of time, at least not and do a very good job of it. So, you know, I don't know, maybe it could be done, but I think that's going the wrong direction. You know, that's sending the wrong message, and it's teaching DMs to be poor DMs. You know, why would we do that? We should be teaching DMs to be better DMs. And I think a good GM prepares and thinks about things ahead of time and comes to the table prepared and ready to go, and, you know, saves the improvisational juice for the unexpected things that the players do and the unexpected directions they go and just things they're inspired to come up with on the fly. But as far as, you know, what's in this room, like, you shouldn't have to improv that. You should already know what's in the room. So that was very much behind my philosophy of designing the adventure. You know, I didn't try too hard to make this something that you could just run out of the box. That wasn't even on my radar, but I did try to give a lot of advice for GMs as far as how to do this, especially if you're a newer GM. And, you know, that was also part of the keeping a hold on the amount of read aloud text, because I think a lot of read aloud text can send at least some GMs the message of, oh, hey, I don't have to prepare for this. I can just read these sections and I'm good to go. And I don't think that's the case. And I definitely didn't want to send that message with this adventure. All right. Well, that's about everything I can think of to talk about the Trickster's Labyrinth. If you have any other questions or follow-up questions about what I talked about today, feel free to get a hold of me. You can shoot me an email at gamemastersjourney@gmail.com. Or you could ask me in the Game Master's Journey community. I'd be happy to follow up and answer any other questions or whatever. Probably, I'm not going to do another whole episode about this. I'm sure this was enough for most of you. But if there are questions that I think the answers will be enlightening to people, I could cover that in a feedback segment in a later episode. Thank you for coming along with me on my Game Master journey today and my first experience publishing an adventure for D&D. Had a lot of fun with it, and you know, we'll see how it does. And like I've said before, I have other ideas for adventures and even entire campaigns that I could do in the future, and kind of always quietly working on these things in the background. If nothing else, it's something I can run for groups that I run. And yeah, you know, maybe someday in the future I'll do this again and put something else out there if people are interested. I definitely enjoy doing it. I mean, I know I talked a lot about how much more time and work it was than what I expected, but that was more of just an FYI for those of you who might be considering this for yourself, because I really did not know what I was getting into. But now I do. So, you know, if I'm really fired up about something and have the time to do the work, I'd definitely do it again. And it was fun. It was an experience and I really enjoyed it. And, you know, the more people who enjoy what I do and the more people who let me know that they enjoy what I do, the more motivated I am to do more. And I think that's only human. I want to give a shout out and a thank you to listener GM Hubris7 for your 5-star review on iTunes. Hubris7 says, I listened to this podcast while I was transitioning from 4th edition to 5th edition. I was driving from Madison, Wisconsin to New Orleans, Los Angeles. Oh my God. To New Orleans, Louisiana. I'm not used to seeing that abbreviation, I guess. And Lex was the perfect companion. His honest and experienced long view on the art of DMing smoothed the transition perfectly. In particular, Lex's latest content has involved reading the key parts of the 5th edition Dungeon Master's Guide and Player's Handbook, sometimes word for word, and then offering personal commentary and clarification on the books. This is the sort of obvious content that we weren't getting from the official D&D podcast that I think is brilliant. Thank you. I appreciate that. I think that's kind of obvious content the official podcast should be doing too, but since they're not, I will. My only gripes are that Lex is a little hard on 4th edition and the Yuan Ti. that's great. Well, I apologize. We all have our opinions. I will try to not go on too much about my dislike of 4th edition and Yuan Ti. And in all fairness, I have to say that my dislike of 4th edition is purely a spectator thing. I never played it. I never ran it. I read the books. I watched some actual play on YouTube, and that was enough that I didn't want to play or run it. So, you know, I can't really say too much about it one way or the other because I don't have personal experience of it, just reading it and watching other people play it. But hey, if you liked it, you know, that's great. You do you. And as far as you want to, you know, I'm just not a fan, but that's okay. I mean, I like elves. I know people that hate elves. So maybe you're an elf hater and then we're even. let's see, back to the review. Also, Lex almost never includes personal anecdotes from his own campaigns. Lex, please, I don't care what edition it's from. Tell us how you came to hold your strong opinions on DMing. Oh, okay. Wow, I don't do personal anecdotes about my own campaigns, huh? I tell you what, Hubis7, if you're still listening, which I would assume you are, you gave a 5-star review, reach out to me, shoot me an email, or leave a comment on the website, or leave a comment in the community, and let me know more about, like, when you say personal anecdotes from my campaigns, like, more what exactly you're talking about, or examples of the kind of things you'd like to hear. That's definitely something I could do and would be happy to do on the show, is talk more about the actual games I'm running. So right now I'm running Hidden Shrine. I'm not sure what exactly you want to hear, as far as the anecdotes and, how I came to hold my strong opinions on DMing. Yeah, you know, that could be a thing of the skunk can't smell his own stink kind of thing. Like, I don't really know what are my strong opinions on DMing. What do you see as my strong opinions on DMing that you'd like to know? Like, why do I think that, or how do I think that? That sounds like great things to talk about on the show. I'd love to talk about that on the show. So, Hubris7 or anyone else listening, if there are opinions I've stated on the show and you want to know why I have that opinion, let me know. If there are anecdotes from my campaigns that you'd like to hear, or the types of anecdotes, let me know. I would love to talk about that stuff on the show. You know, one of the hardest things, let me tell you, one of the hardest things about producing the show is just coming up with what to talk about. I mean, this is the 157th episode, and trying to come up with something to talk about that I haven't already talked about sometime in 157 episodes is really the hardest part of producing this show. And these are two things right here: anecdotes for my campaigns and why I have the opinions I have. That, I mean, we could get all kinds of content out of that. That I'd love to do it, but I feel like both of those things are things, like, I have these blinders on and I don't really know. Like, I don't know what things from my campaigns people want to hear about, like what people are interested in as far as anecdotes. And I mean, I have so many opinions. I don't know which are opinions that are interesting for me to talk about to people as far as why I think that way. So let me know if you are Hubris7 or you agree with Hubris7 and you like to hear this kind of stuff. Give me some examples of anecdotes I could discuss or opinions I could elaborate as far as why I have those opinions. That would be great. Let me think. So I'm running Hidden Shrine. I just ran a session earlier this week, Let me see if I can think of something that's happened that I could talk about that might, I don't know, that might be interesting. Yeah, I don't, I'm coming up blank. I'm sorry. I can't, I need your guys' help. And yeah, maybe some of you even watch my sessions on YouTube and you could even say, hey, you should talk about that thing that happened. Like, I don't know, anecdotes from my campaigns. Yeah. Now one thing that I think I will do, I mentioned this, I think last week, and I have gotten some feedback from people that are interested in this is, once I've finished Hidden Shrine, I will come back and talk about it and talk about, some of the things I changed about the adventure and why I changed them. And, also some problems that I've had with the adventure that I've encountered since I've started running it that I didn't realize when I did the review of Tales from the Yawning Portal. Because, you know, it's one thing to read an adventure. It's totally another thing to run it. So there have been things that I've learned since running it that I'm like, oh, I wish I would have mentioned this in the review. So I'll talk about that, for sure. So, okay, here's one thing. This maybe spoils Hidden Shrine a little bit, but not that much. I'll be vague enough that I don't think it will be too big of a spoiler. So something that happens in Hidden Shrine is that at a certain point, the player characters may get a magic weapon that does more damage against plant creatures. Okay. And now me, if I was designing an adventure and one of the pieces of treasure I was giving out in the adventure was a weapon that did more damage against plant creatures, I would, you know, put some plant creatures in the adventure. You know, it's like, what is the point in having a weapon that does extra damage against plant creatures if you never encounter a plant creature? But there are no plant creatures in her Hidden Shrine of Tomoaken as it's written in the adventure. So guess what I did? I added some plant creatures. I'm not going to tell you what they are. I don't want to spoil it because the players haven't encountered them yet. But I did add some plant creatures because I thought it was pretty lame to give the PCs a sword that does extra damage against plant creatures and have them never encounter a plant creature. And I did want to trust to my memory to remember to add one in a later adventure. And who knows, you know, like, I guess that's there's a piece of advice for you. I think I've said this on the show before, but it's been a while. If you have a cool idea, if you have something you want to do in your campaign, do it now. Don't be like, okay, I'm going to do this when the players are 15th level, or I'm going to do this in 6 months when they get to this spot, because you never know what could happen. And there have been so many times in my past where I had really cool ideas of things I was going to do in the future in the campaign, and we just never got there. Maybe we didn't play that long. Maybe the player that cool idea involved quit before we got to that point, or the character died, or they changed characters, or by the time we got to that point, that cool idea just didn't make sense anymore or whatever. But it's happened more times than I can count, and it's such a drag when that happens. So if you have a cool idea that you're excited about, don't put it off. Figure out a way to use it as soon as possible. Figure out a way to use it next week in the next session you run. Use that cool idea if you can at all. So I didn't want to put it off. So I'm like, you know what? I'm going to put a plant creature in this adventure. And that's, you know, when I talk more about things that change about the adventure and why, I think it's too easy, honestly. So I dialed it up a bit because you know, it's a pretty long dungeon, and I felt like as easy as it is, that if I ran it as written, the players were going to get bored with it before we finished it because there's no challenge. So I didn't like up the difficulty on every encounter because I don't want it to be a slog, and you want there to be a nice balance of, you know, some encounters are easier, some are harder, you know, things like that. But I did add some more challenging encounters. And I did that a few different ways. Some of them, for instance, there are encounters where they encounter a single monster all by itself, and it's not even a legendary monster, and it's not even a high CR monster. So the player characters are level 5 and they're encountering a single level or single CR 3 monster. So, you know, it's just like, why are we doing this? So those kinds of encounters, I either added some minions to make it more fun and more challenging, or I would make the monster, give it maximum hit points, or a couple of them that I thought were cool monsters, but I just thought, you know, it's just not going to be challenging because there's only one of them. I haven't done it yet, but a couple of them I'm actually going to make legendary versions of those monsters. So I talked about today how in my adventure, I made some monsters that were basically just my legendary version of a monster from the monster manual. So I'm doing that with some of the monsters in Hidden Shrine, where I'm just making it legendary, giving it legendary actions, giving it more hit points. I usually, when I make a monster legendary, I either give it maximum hit points or I give it 75% hit points. So when you look at a monster in the monster manual, when you look at the recommended hit points, that's assuming they're getting the average on each of their hit dice. So if they have a D8, that's assuming they're getting 4.5 hit points per D8. So, you know, one of the ways Wizards recommends that you can make a monster tougher is just give it maximum hit points. So it's getting 8 hit points on every D8. So, you know, sometimes I feel like that's too much, but the half isn't enough. And so I'll split the difference. So on the D8, I give them 6 hit points every D8, or maybe 7, or anywhere in between. And, you know, this is something interesting that I've changed recently about the way I run the game. You know, in earlier editions, we didn't have the average hit points given. And so I would always roll hit points for monsters. Then 5th edition, we had the average hit points, but I thought it was kind of lame to use them because then it's like, oh, every goblin has the same number of hit points. So I still rolled hit points for all my monsters, but it gets time consuming, right? It takes a lot of time to roll all those hit points. So then what I started doing is I started rolling hit points for monsters, but I would only use what I rolled if it was higher than the average hit points. Otherwise I use average. And then I thought, you know, that's just taking too much time. So now I tend to use the average, unless it's a situation where I want it to be a really difficult encounter, or I think it's too easy, and then I'll up their hit points. But I don't always do 100% hit points. I might, like I said, do 75% or 60. I just look at the hit die, right? So if the monster has D12s for its hit points, and you know the average number that you're given of hit points is assuming that they're getting 6.5 hit points per hit die, well, maybe I'll assume they're getting 8 hit points per hit die, or 9, or 10, or 11, or 12, just to get it exactly where I want it. And I play with that. So I'll do that, stuff like that. Other ways that I've changed, some of the encounters, I've just changed the monster entirely. There's a certain encounter where they encounter one monster, and they literally use a CR 1/2 monster that only has 1 hit point, and its armor class is like really low, like, I don't know, 10 or 11 or 12 or something. Like, it's ridiculous. And I was like, are you kidding me? Why is this even here? Like, you know, this is just point, like, why even roll initiative for this, right? So that, I swapped it out for a monster that is similar. It actually looks very similar to the monster, so I can actually use the same description of it, and it fits kind of the theme of what's going on with the encounter, but it's a much more powerful monster. I think it's a CR5 is what I switched it with, and it's going to be fun. So that'll be fun. So yeah, some of the encounters, I just changed the monster to something else. And then there were a couple places where I added monsters. So actually, I can talk about this because this won't be a spoiler for my players, at least, and it won't be a spoiler for the adventure, because this is something I added. There was a certain room in the Hidden Shrine that there was nothing there as far as an encounter. And so I added a Beulet, or a Beulet, or a Bullet, or however you want to say it, a Land Shark. And because I thought it made sense, because they're kind of underground, and I thought it made sense this thing could be burrowing underneath. And it actually worked really well in the actual session, because one of the player characters was throwing a rock around making noise, And then they found a secret door that made noise when it opened. So it actually worked really well. I mean, I was planning to do the encounter anyway, but it worked really well because they were making all this noise. And specifically, they were banging objects against the floor and the walls of this chamber, which would send vibrations through the floor, which the bulle going underneath would sense. And so it actually worked really well. And this thing came up out of the floor and they got to fight the bulle. And that was fun. And it was a pretty cool encounter because bulles, they're not going to wipe your party because they only get one attack around. But they have a pretty good bonus to hit, and they do quite a bit of damage. So even though, I mean, they killed the thing in like two or three rounds, and I didn't like give it max hit points or anything like that. I just ran it out of the book pretty much. But even so, it got a surprise round on them. It got surprise on them. Let's just say it that way. We don't have surprise rounds anymore. But it surprised them, so it got to do some damage to a couple of them right away. And then it got a couple more hits in. And just because it does so much damage, you know, it messed a couple of the PCs up pretty bad, even though overall to the party overall, it wasn't a super challenging encounter. And a big part of this adventure is resource management because it's difficult for the PCs to rest. Even short rests are difficult. And so you have to kind of manage your hit points and your other resources. And so even, you know, doing a little damage here and there, I think the idea at least is that it adds up. But I just felt like it wasn't really there. But that one encounter, I mean, that did some damage and definitely used up some resources. And it was fun and it was thematic and I felt like it fit and it was fun to do. And so I'll do stuff like that. And I've been known to, I mean, my players probably don't know I do this. I don't know. Maybe they do. I've been known to just pull an encounter out of my butt because I'm bored or because I think the players are bored or because I feel like it's been too long and nothing interesting has happened. I'll just boom, something happens. A monster comes out of the shadows or phases out of the floor or whatever, just to kind of keep things interesting. So even running a published adventure, I'm not afraid to just pull an encounter out of nowhere if I feel like it's needed. So anyway, wow, huge tangent. Getting back to Hubris 7's review, thank you so much for the review. And again, to you or anyone else, if you have specific requests or ideas about anecdotes from my campaigns you'd like to hear about, definitely let me know. I'll definitely do that. And I'll try to kind of keep a mind from now on as I'm running for things I could talk about on the show. But it'll really help me out if you can give me some examples of the kind of things you'd like to hear. And then also, you know, strong opinions I have about DMing and about running games that you'd like to know how I came to have that opinion and why that I have that opinion. Let me know specific ones and I'd happily talk about it. And again, I'll try to keep it in my head when I'm talking about stuff. If I notice I'm talking about any opinions, talk about like how I came to have that opinion. But yeah, I'm happy to do that. So that's going to wrap it up for episode 157. If you'd like to get a hold of me, go to starwalkerstudios.com. Everything is there. Twitter, email, Google+, Facebook, Pinterest, YouTube, Game Master's Journey, voicemail. You can call and leave a message. You might hear it on the show. I love to hear from you guys, any and girls. Sorry, I'm Midwest. Originally, guys was our gender neutral pronoun, even though it's not gender neutral. Ladies and gentlemen, I love hearing from you about the show, ideas for future topics, questions, topics you'd like to hear on the show, anything. I love to hear from you guys and girls. God, I did it again. So you can find everything that you need to find, starwalkerstudios.com. You can also find out how you can become a patron and support the show. Find my Amazon referral link. Find the Trickster's Labyrinth, find the donate button, all that stuff, starwalkerstudios.com, it's all there. So I hope you have a chance to run your favorite RPG this week, and I hope you have a chance to play your favorite RPG this week. I'll be back soon with another episode of Game Master's Journey. I'm going horse, so until then,
game on. This has been a Starwalker Studios production, your source for quality gaming and hobby podcasts.
This episode's music, courtesy of Cloudwalker, Transboy, Renfield, Stanko, and Ish. See the show notes for more details at starwalkerstudios.com/gamemastersjourney.